Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
All right, well, this has nothing to do with you. That is not a warning, but it is the name of the new book from Lauren Carter. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, I mean, not every book uses the title within the text, but this book does.
Multiple times, actually.
Yeah, and so I'm curious, like, was this always the title, or did the title evolve?
Titles for me come pretty early on.
Okay.
So, yes, it was, you know, once I got about 50 pages in, I probably had that as the title.
Kind of the first time you wrote, "This has nothing to do with you"?
It could have been. Yeah, it could have been. It's hard for me to remember.
Sure,
it was
yeah.
like 5 years ago.
Yeah.
But yeah, it. I get titles pretty early on. That one I did get early on, and so it kind of guides what I'm doing, right? It guides the story. It guides the underlying themes in the story. It guides what I want to explore, what questions I want to bring up.
Does it kind of create like a pen or like some sort
yes.
of like holding area in which the book then exists?
Absolutely. Like a prism. Even, you know, like
an
area where
yeah.
things can kind of reflect, a hall of mirrors sort of thing.
Right.
Right. So because fiction, like any art, is not life, it replicates life. So it's really helpful to put those boundaries around it so that you can look at what you're trying to say in multiple different ways.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, in talking to authors, sometimes like some people are like plot first, right? Like that they have like kind of an idea of like narrative structure, and then some people are character first.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, do you hew to either of those
yeah,
two?
Yeah, totally. Character.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Mel actually arrived early. I wrote three short stories, one which won the Prairie Fire Fiction Contest called Rhubarb, with her in it. And it's sort of different biographical details. You know, she's different versions of herself in all of those stories, but she was around. So when I started writing this one, I thought I was writing another linked short story, and it kept going. And I started with the high school graduation. I started with that night when there's a murder and, you know, they don't know what it is at first, which is actually based on a real story from the night I graduated from high school.
Okay.
There was a murder on the highway, which is still unsolved to this day. So I decided to kind of take that and riff on it and play with it.
So if she was a character in this other short story, and like you said, like she evolves, like did you start writing this story not necessarily knowing that was her?
Oh, yeah, totally. I start everything blind.
Right.
I start everything with some kind of sentence comes into my head and I go. And because of that, I write a million drafts and I have there's a lot of chaos. There's a lot of confusion when I don't know what the story is about yet, where it's actually going. But I just persist in trying to unravel some kind of a thread of plot within that first draft. And then I'll go back to that and see what is the arc here? What is happening?
So you take that real life murder, the
yeah.
unsolved one, you use it as kind of a jumping off point for this story. And then you're incorporating a character that you've already written in the past.
Yeah.
Like, is there like an intentionality to that? Do you actually think in your head, like, I want to put this person on this course?
No, she just came. She came in a different way. So it's less like she's a solid character that I'm moving around and more like she's a voice starts talking and through me. It's a channeling thing, Michael. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. No, no. And I'm always curious. Like,
I'm very
interested in like the mechanics of creation.
Yes.
And kind of like how.
Oh, it's so mysterious. And really, I don't want to do that thing where I'm saying, oh, my characters just decide what they want to do, because it's not like that.
No. And like
it's more collaborative for me.
And if you have like a million drafts, that means you're sifting through to figure out which things they're
exactly.
doing.
Exactly. And I'm sifting through to figure out, what do I need to happen in order to show what I'm trying to say more effectively? Because it's not all about her. It's also about the dynamics of the theme that I'm exploring, you know, that idea of empathy and that idea of, you know, what are we responsible for outside of our own lives, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Early on, the central character reflects about, you know, her dad's way of looking at the world and sort of closing himself off for it and saying, like, it doesn't concern me.
Yeah.
And that her brother and her mother both gravitate towards, like, feeling the entire weight of the world.
Yeah.
And neither is necessarily presented as the way to go about things.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, Melody is, like, struggling with which way to hew towards.
Mm-hmm.
Did you, it sounds like you intentionally wanted to tackle empathy.
Yes.
But did you grapple with, like, what level of empathy? Like, what?
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, what makes someone overbearing or, like, outside of themselves or, like, you know, like, there's, you know, only so much control any one person has over the world outside them.
Yeah, absolutely. And when do you walk away, right? When do you say, this is too much for me? Or
right.
When are you driven to actions like Bernadette takes, Mel's mom?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think the case with Mel, too, is that she kind of swings back and forth, right? Like, a big part of the book, I think, is her learning how to be a friend, even how to be a good sister, because she is so bound in her own pain. And so she keeps making mistakes, right? One wrong decision after another, trying to cover her tracks, lying to people. She has a propensity for lying. And that, I think, was kind of intentional, because I didn't want to, you know, make it like a overbearing morality tale. I wanted her to be confused. I wanted the questions to be raised rather than to be, like, preachy in any way.
This is not, like, a role model everyone needs to ascribe to.
Oh, God. She makes so, like, I mean, my editor was talking to me about how she just kept cringing, like,
oh,
seeing one mistake after another.
It's like a slow motion car crash at times.
Yes.
Where you just kind of see things coming her way and you're just like, oh, my God, get out of your own way.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's told from her point of view. And mm-hmm. and I wanted to maybe talk a little bit about interiority
mm-hmm.
and, like, how you find that voice and then also, like, propel the, like, plot mechanics through that, like, interiority, right? Because, I mean, people see things their own way and it's not necessarily,
yeah,
like, how things are actually happening, right? This is the Rashomon thing that, right, you know, there's, like,
yeah,
three participants and the fourth is the truth, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So how do you sort of walk that line of, like, this is her story, but, like, she is not necessarily, I mean, everyone's an unreliable narrator.
Yeah. Yeah. And because there are so many secrets in the book that are held from her that she is on this journey to uncover, and bits of, you know, life-changing news that come her way. Like, all of that I had to really get clear in my head. Like, what exactly happened? What happened between their mother and Matt? What were the, you know, stepping stones that night of the graduation? How did that happen? So I needed to be very clear about that. And it took a while for me to figure all that out, you know?
So and what goes into figuring that out?
Just a lot of thought, a lot of looking out the window, a lot of frustration. And sometimes I think, you know, the most beautiful thing is when you're kind of, it's in your head, you're rolling it over, and then boom, it comes to you, right? And I remember when it came to me, the final turning point of mm-hmm. that book, the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak. It is like an epiphany. It just kind of arrives. And I think that happens the more you're dwelling within the story. You know, if you can live inside the story for a time, it will sort of fit the pieces together, or it does for me anyway.
Is it a matter of, like, kind of sifting through those drafts and seeing kind of, like, a circuitous path?
Yes, that too, for sure. And seeing areas that I want to expand on
uh-huh.
and different characters that I can bring in to help shuttle things along, like bringing Mel's boss to life. That was a very late stage thing. That whole part with her work at the end, I don't want to give anything away.
Yeah, I don't want to, like, spoil,
yeah,
like, narrative developments, but I
yeah.
do want to kind of, like, explore kind of,
yeah,
the book as a whole.
Yeah.
So, I mean, because I said, like, it's her telling, Mel's telling, but you, like you said, you bring in these characters and attempt to explore their lives and open these people up. does it present a problem to paint a picture of other people through another person's eyes?
Through
right?
the like, first
it's
person
not your
narrator?
Eyes, it's through the first person.
Yeah,
narrator.
And I think the limitation there is that you are with the character.
Right.
So you have to work with that limitation. Like, it's a first person narrative, and so what she sees is what she sees. And so I can't go into the secret rooms that are held back from her.
Right. She has to find the key and go into the room.
Yeah. Or the key. I mean, I had a lot of fun with scenes with her and her best friend, Josie. And Josie, like, is constantly trying to tell her something and she's not listening and cutting her off. And then, you know, I built that very consciously until finally Josie is like so pissed off at her and
basically, it's like grab her by the
and says,
like,
this is what I've been trying to tell you. This is the news. You're so self-centered. So that was fun.
Right. And that self-centeredness, I mean, obviously for her, it is a coping mechanism, right? Like she has had trauma in her life. And I mean, her first instinct is to run away. She runs away to BC and then she runs to a cave in Sedona.
Mm-hmm.
And even though she comes back, she's still running away.
Yes.
Right?
Like absolutely.
And creating like drama of her own with a dog and other things that keep pulling her away from, you know, being aware that she's supposed to babysit on her brother's anniversary and all. Like she just is like wrapped up in her own thoughts, doesn't even realize like what Josie's trying to say to her.
Yep.
And it's, I have to imagine like trying to make her sympathetic without being like, she's not necessarily like an anti-hero, but she's not heroic.
I mean, I think the real thing about Mel that I really loved about her is her vulnerability. You know, she's still trying. Like she's struggling a lot and she keeps making mistakes, but she's trying, you know? And so I think in that way, she's sympathetic. She felt sympathetic to me, like working with her. I felt for her, you know, and I really love her, right? It's weird. It seems weird to say that, but she became almost to me like a little sister, like ushering her along. And so a lot of the crappier stuff that happens to her came late in the game because I think I was shying away from.
Were you protecting her?
I was protecting her a little bit. And I realized that I couldn't do that, that I had to make the stakes higher so that to propel the reader deeper into it. And so that was an interesting turn.
You say you love her.
Yeah.
Could you imagine yourself writing a character you didn't love? Like, do you find that
I have. Okay. I absolutely have. Like in my first novel in Swarm, Marvin, he's sort of the kind of anti-hero, I guess you'd say. But everyone hates him. Everyone who reads that book tells me, you know, he was not a very likable guy. And so, yeah, he does terrible things. He leads the narrator to terrible things. So, yeah.
Does that feeling towards him make it harder to write a character?
Yeah,
like that?
He was really hard to write. He was very hard to write. And I think if I revisited that book, I would try to understand him more. I didn't spend enough time, I think, with him understanding him. But in this book, I don't think there's anybody. I mean, I don't, you know, Mel's dad, I don't like too much, right? Because he's got some kind of personality disorder, clearly, and there's an aversion there. There's problems there. I think for the most part, all those characters, I could sympathize with them. I could feel for them.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the dad, we're getting Mel's memory of him.
Yeah, and not really any of his backstory.
Yeah.
Which I wanted to put in, but I couldn't.
But I mean, that makes sense in the, like, kids don't necessarily always know their parents, right?
True, yeah.
And particularly, like, kind of when you're younger, your parents are kind of a mystery to you outside of, like, your specific interactions with them.
Yeah,
He does, he's painted as, like, detached.
Yes.
And whether it's like an aloofness or like a purposefulness, right? Because Mel does talk at one point about kind of like his response to like tragedy in the world is like, I can't control that. I can't deal with that. So I'm just going to ignore it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's painted in obviously stark contrast to Matt and her mother.
Yeah.
And so it's not necessarily like he's the villain for doing this.
Yeah.
Because it's obviously impacting Matt and her mother in a very damaging way.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And it's more or less a coping mechanism.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
So, yeah, like, I think the nuance of, the, like, how you see your parent or how Mel sees her parents in this respect is probably, like, a hard kind of thing to juggle.
That was hard. That was tough. And I think writing about the moment they met her parents really helped me with that, because it gave a foundation that any kid would have, right? Any kid would know, or many kids know that story of how their parents met. So I think in a lot of ways, that was almost enough for me to go into their past, right?
Right, and
there's a very specific
vision of that too, because obviously she's on stage, she falls, she's hurt, but her dad doesn't put down his hammer, and that's like a detail that Mel cues in on. Is like, even when he went to help her, there was an obstacle or some sort of like just break between things.
Totally, I'm really glad you noticed that. Yeah, so I'm very conscious. It's like a symbol, right? He's still carrying this kind of violence forward, like. Can't put it down. He can't open and be generous to this woman. And
he gives her one hand instead of both.
Yeah. And that's almost like a picture of their whole relationship. Yeah.
Right. And I mean, it's obviously meant to be apocryphal. But I think a lot of kids' notions of their parents meeting is that way too, right? Whether the root of it has some sort of like very specific thing like this hammer.
Yes.
It's painted, right? It's a reminiscence. It's not like
it's coming.
It's historical fiction.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it's also with everything that's happened, right? With them, with the murder, with everything. Looking back at that, you know,
right?
Yeah.
So speaking of looking back, one of the passages that I really keyed in on was Melanie talking about the past being a marsh, and that, you know, it's pretty to look at, but when you take a step into it, it can like suck you in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Was that like, I'm curious about kind of the genesis of that idea, and like, was that a driving force? Like, had you had a picture like this of history or a person's history in your head when you were writing, or did this come out within the context?
Yeah. I remember when I wrote that passage. So in the process of writing this book, my brother kind of had a breakdown and he died, actually. And I remember I just dove into this book. Like it was a way for me to kind of put everything away, and I just worked on it. And it's about siblings. So, it was how I was dealing with stuff. And I remember that. I remember looking at that and, writing that passage and thinking about everything that he'd been through, like his whole life leading up to that point. He died by suicide. Mm-hmm. So it was a little bit of a nod to him at that moment.
Right.
Yeah.
So when you write an analogy like that, does that, like, I don't want to say take you out of the writing, but like force you to like step back from your writing and think about.
Yeah. Sometimes it's like, it can be really painful, right? It can be really like, it can just hurt. but it also makes it richer. It also makes it deeper, I think.
Particularly in a book that's about processing trauma in a lot of ways.
Absolutely, yeah.
Is it cathartic then to write something like this?
I'm not sure if it's cathartic, because I think catharsis is when you can release, right? I think it's more a kind of processing. It's a kind of rejuggling of pieces, fictionalizing a bunch of different aspects that I want to think about. And in that way, there is a kind of processing that's happening to make this thing. And ultimately, you end up with this product that hopefully sort of speaks to other people too, in terms of asking those questions and considering those bigger things about what it is to be a human.
Right. And yet there's like kind of like a weird kind of like arm bar movement of this, the fact that it's called This Has Nothing to Do With You. And Mel's interior voice basically says that to the reader the first time we read it.
Yeah.
Is it like a challenge or like a meant, you know, because it, I mean, even the idea of like something having nothing to do with you, you know, Matt is super interested in the Rwandan genocide, right?
Yeah.
And it's
yeah.
like, does that have anything to do with you?
Yeah.
No. You know, the issues that Mel has with the dog, right? The dog was very badly treated before she adopts this dog. His, you know, mental state and his inability to kind of handle things.
Yeah.
Does that have anything to do with her? Not necessarily. So, I mean,
yeah.
it's obviously it's the title. So it's a thematic element that comes up again and again.
Yep.
But it does seem kind of like a pushback yeah. against like getting too wrapped up in it.
Well, I think I really like that. I mean, I like that because of what we said earlier about Mel, about how she, you know, is kind. She's a train wreck. She keeps making mistakes. And so the book is really a challenge. I like that idea of it being a challenge because it's sort of like, will you open your heart to this person who's been through all this stuff that you only know about because you're with her in this first person narrative? So does that have anything to do with you, with the reader? And it raises a lot of questions, too, about the power of fiction
mm-hmm.
and what books can do, right? Like what stories can do for us. They can show us people's lives that we think those people have nothing to do with us. But when we read and enter into the depths of their lives through fiction, suddenly we realize, oh, okay, we are all human.
Yeah, this is the way the world works in terms of kismet, as far as I'm concerned. I just happened to read an article about brain chemistry and the fact that researchers think our brains function as storytellers and not as reporters.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
that this is how we process things. And so obviously,
yeah.
in context of a situation like this, yes, of course, we take that challenge
yeah.
of looking at the world through this other person's eyes, through this character's eyes, because that's how we handle things.
Yeah. And that was why I did make a very conscious choice to set it that spring during the Rwandan genocide, because I remember that time and how, you know, so many people I knew, myself included, were watching that unfold with such limited view because the borders were closed. You couldn't see really into it. And asking that question, what does this have something to do with us? Should we step forward, you know, and our government's sort of failing at that over and over again, and Romeo Dallaire being there saying, yes, this has stuff to do with us, come on, and it's still not being enough.
So choosing to situate it then,
yeah,
what kind of work has to go into like detail and research to like mm-hmm. lend legitimacy to it?
I printed out calendars from April, May, June 1994 mm-hmm. and had them on my wall so that I could cross-reference what was happening in Mel's actual life with what was happening in the news. And I also went to the CBC in Toronto when I was home one time. I'm from Ontario originally. And I made an appointment and I went in and I watched a whole bunch of news episodes from various nights on those calendars where I knew Matt was watching
sitting
the news
in front of
or
TV,
yeah. yeah. So that I could see, what's his name? The newscaster guy who just retired a year ago.
Peter
Mansbridge. Yeah, I could yeah. see his terrible 90s ties and and what else was happening too. The elections in South Africa and things like that.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So like weaving that stuff in, does it present a challenge to kind of like incorporated in a way that doesn't seem like shoehorned or forced? Like,
not too much.
No.
Right? Like delicate. I think the secret is to be delicate, like just a little bit here, a little bit there, and not like, this is my research, here it is, you know?
Right, because yeah. there's allusions to like the music, you know, the tapes that Owen would have in his car or
yeah.
his van.
Yeah.
The one thing that kind of stuck out to me was that, you know, Matt's birthday party is an 80s birthday party.
Yeah.
And like, I know that there's like nostalgia for the 80s, but had there already been nostalgia for the 80s in 1994?
Well,
or is
I
this
remember,
something that you're kind of looking back on and
yeah,
creating?
Yeah. I remember having an 80s party in 1992.
Okay.
So I think there was to a certain degree. Like, and I think part of that is not just nostalgia for the 80s, but also nostalgia for the time before their lives fell apart. Because it's Matt's idea to have that party, when things were more innocent, when he had this great life in Toronto and at university, and things seemed really like the world was his oyster, you know? So I think it for him it was a let's go back, let's dial back the clock a little bit and to have some fun kind of thing.
A retreat.
Yeah.
So I guess, I mean, nostalgia aside, memory is its own thing, and we've kind of talked about like how people kind of filter things or tell their own story. But like, did you pull on your own memories of that time also to create kind of the vibe of the book?
Yeah, for sure. Like listening to Linger by the Cranberries, you know, 87 times in a row. those blue shirts that guys always wore in the 90s. Yeah, they were like that. I don't know what they were called, but I remember seeing them everywhere. So things like that, you know, I would pull in. And then sometimes I'd get on the internet and kind of take a look at what was some music that I didn't know about that I wasn't listening to at that time. I had to do some research on the type of big screen TVs that were around then, because Owain has one, and I wasn't sure what it would look like exactly. So right. I had to dig around for that. Yeah.
The other thing about memory, so Mel's job at the library, she's scanning documents.
Yeah.
To, you know, preserve these articles, and she does wonder, like, what's the point? Does anyone care?
Yep.
But obviously, like, you had to go to the CBC and pull from their archives.
Yeah.
And, you know, go online and look at archives.
Yeah.
It sounds like the process itself resolves that question that Mel has. But I think a lot of people who are not necessarily about obliterating the past, but at least, like, going past beyond it and, you know, maybe doing what her father would do.
Mm-hmm.
Shutting themselves off from these things.
Yeah.
There might be like an argument on either side of whether she's, you know, tilting at windmills or actually.
Yeah. And I mean, these are, you know, a lot of kind of small town, small city-ish newspaper articles. But I think in considering that, what I was thinking about was how we looked at things at that time. Like we didn't have any awareness the amount of information we were going to have. Right? The amount of information that would be saved, that would continuously be saved, and that would be like produced every single day of our lives now. So I think at that time, it's such a weird thing to think about. Like she's, you know, going about this effort to scan these things into the early humongous computer, when now it's like snap of the fingers and it's there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was a bit of a how do we look at information? And I think I wove that in a little bit, just in considering, like, how do we see the world outside ourselves? Because it is such a contrast to now, when this morning I was watching MSNBC, you know, just like the ongoing 24-hour news cycle where Matt's like getting the newspaper and listening to CBC and waiting for the 6 p.m. news and stuff
like
that. And
then, like, writing down.
Yeah, taking notes.
Journal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like her job then, was that something that you created because it helped kind of tie into this notion of like memory and preservation?
Yeah, absolutely. And also I was working at a library at the time. And so I was sort of seeing these, you know, the old clippings file from way back, sifting through that and just thinking about, I'm trying to remember when I came up with the scanner aspect, because I had to really look at that and really ask some questions about, would this have been a thing in 1994? It's maybe a little bit early.
Right.
But then I had the idea of that guy at the university donating this like high tech machine. So,
yeah. Well, the book is This Has Nothing to Do With You. Lauren Carter, thanks very much for coming in and talking
Thank
about
you.
It.
Thank you. Fantastic discussion. I appreciate it.